Hadi bakalım.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction Remote Edition. We are here, David Randa, myself, from our very established hidey holes, our bunkers deep below the earth. Maybe we see the end of the world coming. Maybe it has something to do with the leaked signal chats that we got our hands on. I don't know. David, what do you think?
I think I'm at the Capitol, Alverday, and getting back to Bozeman's a Bearcat. But yes, that's really what it is. We're hiding from the Russians. Or something. Yeah.
I like your reference to the Bearcat. It's a heavily armored vehicle, which might have, you know, some usefulness if it's the end of the world. So, yeah. Anyways, David, thanks for joining me. Thank you guys all for joining us at home. David, what are we talking about today?
So, Trump's security aides are in hot water because the boys' group chat got a little too explosive, if you will. And they invited nerd who ruined all the fun. Also, Big Soda bought off some conservative influencers, and that's a whole thing. We'll be getting into it.
Sounds great. Well, let's kick it off with our first story, Signalgate, as you've named it, very appropriately. And we have some receipts from this very chat. Why don't we go ahead and pull those up, David?
Yeah. Let's see here. Why isn't it? It just says remove. It doesn't say present.
I got you. Oh. All right.
There we go. Yeah. There so we go. Presented without commentary, but if you've ever been a boys chat, you know. Okay.
For you audio only listeners, you really have to pull the screen up on this one. You got to jump to YouTube or Spotify to see what we're seeing there, because we can't read it out. That would be inappropriate.
But I like how they named it right. Houthi small group chat. Like, it's perfect.
I would have expected something a little spicier from a group chat name personally. I mean, my group chats are any example. But nevertheless, we did have this really strange leak. So, David, why don't you run down the facts? What exactly happened here this week?
So, an arched neocon journalist, like, you can't underestimate this guy's background when it comes to advocating for war in Iraq, advocating for war with Iran, all of the Middle East wars this guy's about. He's an ex-IDF soldier, all that kind of stuff. American citizen. He, an editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, he got invited to a Signal group chat with some of the high-level members of the Trump administration discussing U.S. military strikes on Houthi rebels in Yemen. So we reported on this last week when it all went down. Was it last week or the week before? I can't tell. Time is weird.
It's all relative in the Trump administration. We're living it through 10 years within one right now. So.
Exactly. So we reported on when it happened. And he was sent the Signal request for connection from National Security Advisor Michael Waltz. We told you a little bit about that guy during the pick selection. He's kind of known as a Trump loyalist, but more of a hawk compared to many other members of the cabinet, the guys we like the best. And he is, I'll be honest, like, he's kind of an establishment figure. Well, he invites him in to that group, probably a mistake. I really don't believe this is an intentional leak. It's too dumb to be an intentional leak. And then 2 days later, Goldberg, after he was added, the bombs start dropping, and it confirms that the signal chat was a thing that was real. So that's the baseline of it. But there's a lot of juicy details in here. It's not just the controversy. It's not just the OPSEC, the operational security question. It's really about, I think, about the interdynamics within the Trump administration, the glimpse it gives us into what's really going on and how they're debating these interventions.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into that stuff, and that's all the most important part of this, I think it's very interesting, A, that you talk about the other people that are involved in this chat. We're talking about Vice President J.D. Vance. We're talking about Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, Michael Waltz, and then just this random guy who nobody noticed. What was his name? Goldberg?
Yeah, Goldberg. Yeah.
Jeffrey Goldberg. How did nobody notice that he was in there or just think, oh yeah, that's the Jeffrey Goldberg that we have on staff here at the White House? Yeah. No, like maybe, yeah, I don't know. Is there somebody else?
Jeffrey Goldberg? Someone screwed up. I don't know how, but it's a pretty royal screw up for sure.
It's a super royal screw up. Now, I mean, there is some speculation I've read, and I don't know if there's any backing to this at all. Michael Waltz has blamed an aide for the mistake, I think that's a pretty standard thing to do in Washington, probably, is just pass the buck. But it could actually be maybe that there is a member of the staff who maybe they disagreed with this decision and they decided, hey, we're going to get this out to the press in a sneaky way or whatever. I don't know. There's that's Goldberg? Purely speculative.
Yeah. Yeah. So like Goldberg would be like the worst person to pick. Right.
Yeah. And they're like, hell yeah, brother.
Yeah. Right. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, this guy, I mean, Goldberg's an anti-Trumper. He's not from the administration. And he's that way from the way that Bill Kristol is, right? Like not like the way that you would anticipate if you were worried about the Houthi situation. It's just the motives are weak. I mean, it's far easier to explain this one with
honest mess up,
right? Yeah. just a whoopsie. And whether or not it was Mayor Waltz, who knows?
Well, and if it was intentional, I mean, what is the likelihood that something like this would work if it was an intentional effort to leak this stuff in a very, very small Signal chat? It's very easy to see who's a member of a chat of that size on an app like Signal. So I don't know. I don't see a lot of validity to it. But anyways, let's get on with it. So what was the meat of what was discussed in the chat?
Yeah, so I had a ChatGPT breakdown, like a real simple kind of time and message sort of thing to make it clear. I tried, for the sake of this podcast, I tried to get the free subscription to The Atlantic, you know, like the trial. And it wouldn't let me. I don't know. It wouldn't let me. So I didn't.
You've been blacklisted.
So I had to piece it all together using multiple sources.
It wouldn't let you. Now, if that's not an example of why mainstream media is dying, I don't know what is.
Yeah, trust me. If you want to join the SCIF and get access to our members-only exclusive stuff, it's not going to be hard. It's pretty easy. Jump right in.
We want you to give us money.
Yeah, exactly.
So what is the order of operations here as the conversation unfolded?
Yeah, so it starts off with Mike Walls kind of introducing it, saying we got a small group chat for Houthi PC discussions. Let's keep this tight, whatever that means. So JD Vance then says, if you think we should do it, let's go. I just hate bailing Europe out again.
Now, at this point, it could be misconstrued that they're planning a bachelor party. We just don't know yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's keep this tight, boys. It's for the boys.
So Pete Hegseth comes in. He says, VP, I fully share your loathing of European freeloading. It's pathetic, capital letters. But Mike is correct. We are the only ones on the planet, on our side of the ledger, who can do this. Nobody else even close. Question is timing. I feel like now is a good time as any. Given POTUS's directive to reopen shipping lanes, I think we should go. But POTUS still remains 24 hours of decision space. Still retains 24 hours of decision space. So obviously, Pete Hegseth is putting the pressure on Vance on his, you know, question of whether or not this is a good thing.
And then Vance responds, and this appears the next day. So the prior message was sent from Hegseth in the morning on the 14th. On the morning of the 15th, J.D. Vance responds, team, I'm out for the day doing an economic event in Michigan, but I think we are making a mistake. Targeting Houthi forces that are attacking vessels in the Suez Canal serves European interests more than ours because Europe has more trade running through the canal. Our trade goes through the Panama Canal more so than the Suez. So this is another example of us bailing out Europe. I know that the president has ordered this, but I think we should consider delaying it until after the G7 meeting in May, when we can have a more coordinated international response. So what do you take from J.D. Vance's reply to Pete Hegseth?
Well, I mean, he's applying the president's foreign policy to the president's policies.
Right.
He's being more America first.
He's exercising some restraint around this and perhaps diplomatically so, such that if they go to G7 and they have a meeting around this, they could mount some sort of coordinated effort, including more European resources rather than just unilaterally going in as the U.S. alone.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So go ahead.
I was going to say, what would be the benefits of either scenario? What are the benefits of the U.S. just going for it versus, you know, mounting a coalition here?
Well, all these bombs cost money. The operational time costs money. This is a huge expense. So there's the financial question, but there's also like the perverse incentive, right? If as long as America is the sole provider of security and shipping lanes all over the world, of course, no one else is going to invest in their own capability to defend their own vessels.
Right.
And really noting that he's right. Vance is right. Europe uses this area. We don't. A very small percentage of American foreign trade is conducted through this area. And we have the Second Amendment. Right? So we can defend our own ships. In fact, you know, this, and this was a bigger story back in the Biden era, but trading vessels have armored up for these attacks, for these pirate attacks, and their increasing frequency. So do we really need to? Like, is bombing the Houthi capital really going to reduce these water attacks? Have they? You know, those are all legitimate questions about, you know, American foreign policy security interests in the area.
For folks that aren't super familiar, can we do a 30,000 foot view, really quick run through American foreign policy history as it regards Yemen specifically?
Yeah, it's a complicated story. we suggested something. We went into this last year. We talked about it last year. And Kyle and I did dive into a little bit recently as well. But in short, the really high level story, and there's been some really good deep dives on this from Scott Horton. I recommend people get into on Anti-War Radio in his work. And antiwar.com has charted this pretty well too. Effectively, what happened is with the turnover in leadership in Saudi Arabia some years ago, there was basically a desire for the new guy to pick up and demonstrate his leadership capabilities and his manliness and his ability to go fight for Saudi interests. And there was a betrayal, and a former person who was allied with the Saudis in Yemen ends up betraying them and then joining the Houthis, who then kind of professionalize their army. They become far more effective. And really it's been a problem in the Red Sea for some time. But what really took off and what's really involved with these strikes, of course, has a lot more to do with Houthi attacks on Israeli vessels after October 7th. And that's why we're engaging more directly now. When before it was a nuisance, now we're going to drop, you know, real missiles and bombs on these guys in order to take out leadership, in order to degrade their military presence, and they have opportunities to do damage.
And why would Trump make this about face at this point, having run on a very anti-war, pro-peace platform?
That's a great question. So we speculated before that it had everything to do with Israel, right? And trying to, you know, in the best, the steel man is that he's trying to remove the pressure of Israel to feel under the gun so that they can go to the table. Like some MAGA influencers will say that. I think the stronger case is that, you know, and related to the Israel theory, is that there is a, he wants to give Israel everything they want. I don't see, like, this is, if there was, they stopped when the ceasefire was put in place. They've started again when the ceasefire was ended by Israel. Israel never entered phase two of Trump's own peace plan, right? And now it had to do with the additional hostages and conflicts around that. But, you know, at the end of the day, the hostages are their only leverage. So if they never actually fully removed the troops from, you know, from Gaza, why would Hamas continue to release the prisoners? I mean, it's just that you don't have to like Hamas to understand their strategic positioning or the cards that they have. So they're playing the cards that they have. And these cards, you know, these are cards of war, folks. These are all awful options and terrible people doing them. So at the end of the day, it's Trump's desire to be a peacemaker in the Middle East is having this weird outcome where now he's dropping bombs on another country. And note that throughout, the Yemeni war has been underwritten by the United States the entire time, right? So just a quick reminder, every single, you know, flight was manned by a Saudi, but the engine was repaired by an American, was refueled by Americans. It was, you know, the intelligence was conducted by American intelligence. I mean, it's been underwritten by the American military state the entire time. So this has really been our war with using the Saudis as proxies against the Houthis, because the Saudis want a war.
Gotcha. Does this represent a meaningful about face, do you think, for the Trump administration regarding their overall foreign policy positioning?
Oh, that's a good question. So at the end of the, I mean, we do have progress on Ukraine, right? So this week there was an agreement not to do any more naval attacks in the Black Sea. And there was an agreement on not attacking energy resources for either country, trying to preserve infrastructure and things like that, trying to limit the scale and scope of the war in Ukraine. And honestly, for a lot of folks, I think for the most pro-peace of us, the war in Ukraine was a higher priority than the Middle East. Intercontinental ballistic missiles tipped with nuclear warheads is a far bigger danger to global civilization than what's going on in the Middle East. But obviously, and then Trump comes in with the whole Houthi thing, and he's blaming Iran, and then he's getting all this pressure from the neocons to go to war against Iran. So it's kind of incoherent, but this is kind of representative of the text messages, right? So even after that, Vance makes his pitch for why he thinks this is a problem, kind of stepping out a bit because, the VP doesn't have a formal role, right? He's kind of there in case the president dies. There's not a lot to do other than to be the president's attack dog, which he's been, good at. He's been doing that job.
And but the guy who goes to Michigan for economic tours.
Yeah, right. Zelensky a hard time in the Oval Office when Zelensky's looks like he's going back on what he said he was there to do.
And becomes the subject of some amazing memes as well. I have to give Vance credit for leaning into that one.
100%. So, he doesn't have to do this. He doesn't have to be involved in policy. A lot of VPs aren't always involved in policy. Obviously, we know like Dick Cheney was, but other ones haven't been. How much was Kamala involved in policy, you think? Really. Other than being the border czar, which he did a really great job with, I'm told. So at the end of the day, how it ends is with, Mike Walls basically saying, understand those concerns, but the president's made his decision. We need to proceed. Hegseth says, I agree. We can't keep kicking the can down the road. It's time to act as now. I don't know what that means. But there's, it's not a – is it a foreign policy departure? Right. That's an excellent question, right? But I think that only is for – those of us who really want MAGA to mean something, right? Not just be Trump's instinctual impulse that's really disposable, like all concepts are for Trump. It's all just negotiation. There's nothing really, I think the only thing he really believes in is tariffs. I don't think there's any way you can convince him on something else. But as far as like dropping bombs on somebody, it's kind of like, hell yeah, brother. Let's go. Let's go do it. We need to do it. Lacoud is telling me to go do it. Let's go do it.
Yeah. And then, right after that, Pete Hegseth shares those operational details about the strikes, which were redacted for national security purposes. Mm-hmm. And that is really the part that is shocking, I guess, to a lot of people, that these details would be shared in a text thread, let alone one with somebody who was not carefully vetted in there, such as the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. And then obviously that's the part that Jeffrey Goldberg cites as the validation that this text chat is real, that those things actually did happen, or mm-hmm. something pertaining to that actually happened.
Mm-hmm. At the time frame that they said it would happen, right? So he waited until it happened and then found the confirmation on X and then posted his article.
Yeah. So, I've never, had a look behind the curtain like this before. I'm sure a lot of people are in this position. Is mm-hmm. it common for insiders in the cabinet to have small group signal chats to communicate?
Well, you wouldn't think so because, as we know, signal is not a bomb-proof thing, right? I assume these are being done on government-issued phones. Like, that's how it works, right? If you work for the government, you get issued a phone that has extra, government spyware on it to make sure you're not using it improperly. And to make sure that no one else is spying on your phone, right? So there, it's strange that, but I wouldn't be surprised. They do use mainstream applications on that. But you think there would be like a super secure like government application for these sorts of things, especially internal?
I'm sure Elon is working on one now at this point. After this all happened, he's like, don't worry, I got this. We're building that by tomorrow. Yeah,
we'll have a framework out in no time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, it's strange, right? Because we know, like Tucker Carlson, for example, his signal was hacked. I've long suspected that's not a third party hack. It's not an interception hack. It's probably had to do with like a key, like a something on his phone that's tracking what he's doing, and then covertly uploading his activity to somebody else.
TikTok, probably
in the intelligence state. TikTok, yeah, right. Well, I'm skeptical of that, but I think the intelligence state at minimum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of suspicion as well that Signal was created by or heavily funded by the CIA, and there may be a backdoor, which I don't know. I guess at this point with, you know, Tulsi Gabbard at the head of it, maybe it's a friendlier relationship. Who knows?
Well, I mean, well, actually, something about that. It's important to understand Onion Network, Signal, other cryptographic secure networks were created and had secured initial resources through things like Navy intelligence and things in the intelligence agencies. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they were meant to be used as spying tools, because one of the things that you want if you're an intelligence agency is to be able to have a commonly used apparatus to do secure information transfer to other people that doesn't show that you're part of an intelligence agency. And then additionally, the more traffic you have on these lines, whether that's Onion Network or on Signal, the more traffic you have, the more you can get lost in that traffic, right? So at the time of the late 90s, early 2000s, it was largely seen that they had lost the cryptography fight. They had seen that they really couldn't change Americans' attitudes about cryptography. So rather than fighting it and trying to undermine it, they just went with it. And then began to use and develop a lot of those tools alongside of it so that they could do that. So it is a really great book. It's called Surveillance Valley, about that, and kind of like the origins of a lot of the Silicon Valley surveillance state stuff. So it's one of those kind of yin yang things. It kind of came with both in that sense. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's unsecure or that there's a backdoor built in. But, you know, because it is open source, if there was a backdoor, you know, people who are interested in security would, you know, probably have found it by now.
For sure. So what has the response been at this point to these leaks, to this conversation that was had, to the activity going on in Yemen?
Yeah. So if you watch the mainstream response, it's really telling what they decide to focus on. So the New York Times had an article. It was now Europe knows what Trump team calls it behind its back. Pathetic.
Well, I don't think that's any real secret that Trump does not have a lot of love lost for Europe.
Yeah. So like, and I think titles of that article kind of demonstrate, you know, the need to probably show to the audience that, well, we're just losing our reputation overseas. Like Americans care. Like the only people who care about that are like coastal elites who subscribe to the Atlantic and the New York Times. Like those people care. Oh, my friends in Paris will think less of me now that we have Trump as president. Not like the average American's like, I don't care. Why do I care? Why do I care what Europe thinks of us?
I imagine a lot of Americans are probably like, yeah, he's right. They have been freeloading off us forever. Look at NATO. Look at the war in Ukraine. Look at all this stuff. Like they have been. I agree.
I remember some years ago, there was some polling about allied burden sharing, and it was an enormously popular issue. So might have changed between now and then, but I doubt it. I mean, at the end of the day, asking Europe to do its fair share in global security, I think is completely reasonable. And noting that New York Times article does not mention that almost none of our trade goes to the Suez Canal or really clearly say what Vance's point was. It only points at Hegseth and says, like, Hegseth called them pathetic. I'm just reminded of this because it's like, it's one of those things that can go by really easy if you're not paying attention. When after the fall of Ukraine, the lady who was in charge of the Ukraine strategy for Obama, she works for NED Newland. Now. Newland. Victoria Newland is on the phone, got leaked or hacked by somebody, probably the Russians, leaked to WikiLeaks, released online. And in that, she plots out what the future of Ukraine is going to be with her aides and other people on the ground in Ukraine. And basically in that she's talking about the different interest groups of who wants who where. And in that she says, fuck the EU. And when it goes out to the press, the press is like, can you believe that she would use such a word rather than talking about that we overthrew a government and are now planning the new government. Yeah. Right. And so it's like, it's this, let's not discuss whether or not we should be bombing the Houthis. Let's not discuss J.D. Vance's real concern about the more narrowly defined American security interest questions here. Let's discuss Hegseth calling them pathetic. You know, I mean, just that's journalism, guys.
It's modern legacy press journalism is what it is.
Yeah. So the Washington Post says Trump defends National Security Advisor Tim Walz in secure Signal group chat blunder.
Not Tim Walz.
Now,
Michael
was
Walz.
That Tim Walz? No. What?
Michael
what?
Michael Walz.
Michael Walz. Did I say Tim Walz?
You did. You did. He's still checking his Tesla stock. He's not tuned in.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and this is one thing, and I've been critical of Trump some, but I'm gonna go out on a limb here because I haven't seen anyone say this. The right wing is full of branding cowards. It's just true. I've been
Can you
on
explain
so
what you
many,
mean by that?
Yeah. So I've been operating professionally on right wing and libertarian politics since 2011, and over that time, what I've seen is a systematic response from Republicans and conservative organizations that if anyone gets any criticism from outside the organization, you just fire them, you get rid of them. They said something nasty, they made some mistake, they embarrassed us, so they get rid of it. But the left does not do that. The left will stand up for that person and fight for that person until the bitter end and then go get them another job. They take care of their own people. And the right does not do that almost ever. And so I assuming that this was just a general mistake, right? Assuming this wasn't a leak, and I still don't grasp a bit of motivation there, granted everything. But as if it was indeed just a mistake, like I deeply appreciate a right winger actually having the courage to be like, no, it was a mistake. It was an accident. It happened. No one got hurt. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, like, this is a big deal. I'm not saying it's not, but from Trump's perspective of him covering for his own guy who's been loyal to him, it's a breath of fresh air. Because I that's one of the things I hate about the way the right wing treats its own people sometimes.
That's really fair. Yeah, that's super fair. And interesting to note that difference. Why do you think that is?
Mostly about media control. So the left has always had an inherent advantage when it comes to the way they're covered by the press. I mean, you got guys like Anthony Weiner who just serially sending dick pics to people. And you know, the press will be like indiscretion, you know, like not serial dick pic sender, you know, it's indiscretion, you know, like it's just the way it's covered and how the temper is and how easily frightened the right-wing donor class is of, and it's part of corporate culture too, I think, I suspect. Mm. Like corporate culture is very much like, well, you're damaging our group effort here, so you're out, good luck, sorry.
Yeah, that's interesting.
While the left is more, it was more about solidarity, so they're more likely just to stick it out and be like, no, he's one of us, so we don't care, deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, perhaps it has something to do with the fact that by nature, Republicans are just more sort of conservative and maybe, you know, perceived a little bit more uptight. And so when something comes along that is a, you know, a relative faux pas, they're much more quick to try to guard the remaining reputation as opposed to say, no, this is not a big deal. Relax. There's not a lot of confidence there. Whereas like with the left being branded more, you know, an insurgency almost, you know, this like scrappy street level thing, even though it's extremely corporate and extremely well-organized and very monolithic in a lot of ways, they have the brand to cover that. But do you think that the fact that the media's influence has changed so much and so much more of the power is in the independent media space that Trump feels like maybe there's a little more air cover here for him to go to bat for his guy?
Maybe. And also maybe just Trump's a different animal. At the end of the day, like maybe he's just more defined by loyalty. And I actually suspect it's mostly that, you know, because don't get me wrong, the left does deal with their problems, but they're more likely to deal behind closed doors and later on, and they're more likely to give a golden parachute. Right. And I just don't, I don't see your average Republican Senate behaving any different now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not even saying that necessarily every time they should, right? There could be bad actors. It could be people who deserve it. But I'm just saying this is a trend. This is a forest, not a tree observation that I've noticed over a very long period of time. And I'm actually appreciating in this given moment, granted, that there wasn't a real cost here other than just embarrassment. And actually a public service, right? A public service, because we all now know who in the administration is actually America First and who isn't.
Very true. And I imagine this probably fortifies J.D. Vance's brand in the eyes of a lot of America First and anti-war conservative and libertarian circles, wouldn't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at minimum, Adam, like, and he's not even saying we shouldn't do this on the moral crisis of murdering a bunch of people. He's not doing this because he doesn't want to back the Saudis, which are not real allies. I mean, like, the Wahhabist ideology has been a real problem for a lot of the West for a long time. He's not doing this for moral reasons. He is simply making a strategic question and applying their own principles about what they told the American public to themselves, and then saying we should do this in coordination with the Europeans. Just wait a month so we can do this after G7 and actually have a coordinated response with Europe. That's it. But that's not in line with the goals of the Likud party. So therefore, got to do it now.
Very interesting. So where do we go from here on this issue? Is this going to have fallout?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, so part of the fallout has been that Congress, a lot of Congress, and in fact, all legislation happens by text messaging, right? It's a fast, immediate, gets right to the person. I'm lobbying in Helena. I text message all the time, right? It's just what you do. So, like, now all these groups of this report from Axios, Scoop, Trump admin bombshell scrambles Congress's signal chats, meaning all the staffers are now like, oh, like,
gotta check and make sure there's no journalists in there. I mean, it shouldn't be that hard to make sure that you're chatting securely. Just make sure you're chatting with the people you know you're chatting with. That doesn't seem that hard.
Right. Yeah. And one thing too, we don't know how many aides were in this chat. All you ever really reported was just who mentioned anything. So there could be a lot of aides monitoring and, being useful for that. So maybe just slipped in there. I don't know. And one of the ones, and I thought this was the best take, and actually it was from the Gray Zone. Actually, I want to show it because it's too good not to. The Gray Zone has this article, which I think is really good. It's why did Jeffrey Goldberg leave the bomb Yemen signal chat by Max Blumenthal. And say what you want about Max Blumenthal, the guy is fearless, and he'll go there, right? What his case here is that, Goldberg literally gets gifted a journalistic, like, highest scoop ever, right? And he just yeets out of there, not long into the thing. At a critical moment when he really could have sat there and actually got real insight into the security stage and his planning, his operation, its actors. I really like this article. I mean, like, it skewers Jeffrey Goldberg as the neocon that he is. It's a really good article. And specifically because it kind of matches up, like, Goldberg's kind of perverse incentives as a neocon being invited to this. That they believe led him to be end up doing this thing, which is just basically not sticking around and making sure that, there wasn't more insights for the public's interest to know these things. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, things should be classified, right? Especially like when we're going to bomb tomorrow, or where we're going to bomb. Those were the details that were shared, and they should be classified, and he shouldn't release those. But the overall picture of, like, the J.D. Vance versus Hegseth dynamics, that's very important for decision making amongst the American people to understand the security establishment. But this guy's such a neocon, he barely even wants to, like, roll that out.
That's so interesting. So do you think he left because he didn't want to have the burden of having to kind of expose some of this stuff or get more deeply into it?
Yeah.
What do you think his motivation was?
Yeah, I mean, that's together kind of their theory. Even in the article, they accuse him of, like, strongly already supporting the war's objections, right? And, to do this whole operation. And that's not surprising, given his background in selling the war in Iraq and then advocating for a war in Iran. So it's just indicative of the dynamic of foreign policy reporting that is way too close to the foreign policy establishment state. Is not your Seymour Hersh's of the world that say, hey, we should have covert ops, but we often do these things in evil ways, and we probably ought to reel these things in. With the amount of, like, appropriate journalistic skepticism to power in the state and especially the foreign policy apparatus. That's like indicative of the difference, right? Max Blumenthal's over here. He's questioning. Is he saying we need to put pressure on these guys to be more transparent and to do that? And you literally get the biggest insight a journalist could ask for, and you don't even stick around to find out.
Crazy. I would have just been a fly on the wall the whole time if it were me. I mean,
yeah,
it's like getting invited to the cool kids club. You're like, oh, I'm just going to hang out and not do anything stupid.
Exactly. That's why I said, up top. They invited a nerd who just ruined the fun, right? They could have spelled the whole word.
Nerds.
God. Nerds. Yeah. So anyways, that was a story on SignalGate. I really, you know who had the first like best take? Liam had a great take on this right off the bat, which is this has made it absolutely clear exactly where the foreign policy establishment role is in the institution, and that, you know, that maybe Trump is losing the plot and that J.D. Vance is the guy who's actually seems to actually understand foreign policy and the implications of MAGA. And that does give you some hope, right? Because J.D.'s a young guy. He's got a long career in front of him. It doesn't mean he'll be president next. No, there's no guarantee there. But it's, you know, traditionally the vice president has run for president. So it could be a good sign for the future.
Well, I think he's got a good shot if they run Kamala against him. I'll just say that.
When she's governor of California for 2 years and then runs against him. Yeah.
Yep. That could happen. It could happen.
Oh, man.
Although, you know, Gavin Newsom has a podcast now, so he's edging more towards the middle. He's having, you know, he had Charlie Kirk on there. He's definitely positioning himself for a run. So I think I would not be the least bit surprised to see him throw his hat in the ring in 28
for president.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Is he actually moving to the middle or is he just trying to look like he is? That's a great question, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I watched the Charlie Kirk thing. Yeah, I watched the Charlie Kirk thing, and I think Kyle's diagnosis was absolutely right. I heard Kyle said describe it first, and then I watched it. I was like, man, that ruined it for me because every time he's talking, I'm like, no, you don't believe that. Get out of here! Like you're dancing around the topic. You haven't actually grokked what's going on.
Well, and he's an absolute windsock of a politician who will go whichever way the wind is blowing. And clearly, he sees the writing on the wall that the woke left is dying. He needs to get on a different ship. And that ship is something more moderate, something that's more palatable to the middle, right? All the Democrats that left the party because they just couldn't do what the Democrats were doing. They couldn't vote for Kamala, whatever. They were just ignoring their needs, right? I think he's trying to position himself to satisfy those needs on behalf of the Democrat Party. But I mean, it's a really good question. If the Democrat establishment can even get their heads out of their own asses, as we talked about last week, to figure out that is the problem and run somebody who doesn't just uphold the, you know, the classic talking points that they've run on for the last 8 years.
Yeah, so, we'll see. The Democrats are in the wilderness now, man. They got a long ways to go, and especially for president. I mean, we'll see if they can do any kind of recovery before 26. But by the election of their leadership, there's no indication. I mean, the way the polling looks, I mean, Ezra Klein did the thing that we showed. That goes to show you they got a long ways to go.
I completely agree.
100%.
Well, speaking of a long ways to go, Maha is a long ways to go on their mission. And this week we have a very interesting story where it seems like, according to X, there have been a variety of conservative influencers who have seemingly, we don't know, been paid by Big Soda to push back against Bobby Kennedy's efforts to ban soda and sugary drinks from the SNAP program, which is your food stamp EBT program. So this is an interesting story to me. I saw it kind of starting to explode in the last 7 to 10 days with a lot of these influencers coming out. You wouldn't necessarily expect. I mean, we've got people like Clown World, who's like a very red pill pro MAGA account. Eric Doherty, I've seen his name all over the place. I don't know all about his background. Not Jerome Powell, just a meme account, but definitely very right leaning. Ian Miles Chong is just, you know, he's been all over the place on the sort of red pill Twitter forever and ever. And all these guys posting very, very similar things in defense of the SNAP program, basically just saying, or in defense of soda being allowed in the SNAP program, basically saying that, oh, it's government overreach to ban people from being able to choose to drink soda. So what's your take on this, David?
Is that government overreach? Yeah, I mean, it does. Okay, so first off, I mean, Robert Kennedy was clear of this from the campaign time, right? Like no one's surprised that this is a push from the Trump administration after he became, took his role as Secretary of Health. So, you know, like anyone who's surprised at this point is like ridiculous, right? Everyone saw this coming a mile away. The question being, you know, like the conservative influencers doing it now, right? And like them pushing back now in such an obviously coordinated way, using the same language, all that kind of stuff. Setting that aside, should we be doing this? Like, what's the philosophical basis for this? And what is, at least for me, what's the libertarian, what's the free society answer for this? And to me, it's pretty clear that what we're talking about when we're talking about sugary drinks is not essential goods meant to keep people from, you know, extreme poverty and malnutrition. Your Pepsi is not nutritious. I don't know, that's shocking news to anybody. If anyone like Diet Coke, not actually good for you. Believe it or not, it's a dessert in a can, and it's not like food.
Yeah, but Diet Coke has fewer calories, so that's good for you, right?
Yeah, the trade-offs might be better. I'm open to that for some people who really struggle with overeating. But when we're talking about when we mean SNAP, is we mean we're taking money from some people and giving it in terms to other people in terms of food benefits. And when it comes to those food benefits, I believe the spirit of the law here is to make sure they have the beans and rice they need not to starve. Not all the luxury that they could desire, because the luxury you could desire is on top of that. If you want to go get Pepsi, you should go get it yourself. But should taxpayers buying you Pepsi? That's what we're talking about. Should other people's money taken from them at gunpoint be there to give you Pepsi? I just don't think so. Like, that's not, I don't, that it, to me, it should be the narrowest possible program, because you shouldn't be able to live in luxury on someone else's dime.
Yeah.
Imagine for a moment, just imagine there's no welfare state at all. Right. It's 1873, and you come on hard times, and you got to go to the local fraternal organization, your local church, you got to go to your local civil society organization, and you got to ask for help. Right. You're on hard times. Are they going to be like, yeah, buy all the liquor you want, right? Buy all the sugary drinks you want. Or are they going to be like, no, like here's some assistance, or expect, you know, and then their expectation is going to be that you expend that conservatively, because there isn't an infinite money machine funding this. This is actually like people's real money that they gave it. And that's the really thing that underlies a lot of this, is this assumption that all this money is indeed free, as if it doesn't come out of people's tax bills. As if when you print the money isn't actually just free. It actually just inflates the money supply and taxes other poor people. So,
you know what it reminds me of, David? And you're exactly right. It reminds me of Oliver Anthony's hit song from last year, Rich Men North of Richmond, in which he says, and I will read the lyrics here, "Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to eat, and the obese, milk, and welfare. Well, God, if you're 5'3" and you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not to pay for your bag of fudge rounds." This is basically the issue we're dealing with right now, is should 100%. Taxes pay for junk food for people who are terribly overweight and who are not contributing their maximum to society because they're unable to, because they're drowning in themselves. And that's a terrible thing. And I have the utmost empathy for people in that situation. Sure. But it is a legitimate question. Should we be paying for people to basically slowly kill themselves with chronic disease because we're enabling them to have whatever junk food they want? I don't necessarily agree with that. And I don't think a libertarian has to dismiss this saying, oh, it's government overreach. Well, it doesn't matter if the government takes something away that they were providing with tax dollars in the first place. That's not like saying, okay, we're banning soda from store shelves entirely. You can no longer buy it. That's a totally different issue.
Yeah, totally agree. And okay. So one of the best cases on and like just like predicting of your economic model, right? So if you're homo economicus, right, is just that if you just look at people are just consumers who just consume stuff. Would you guess that wealthier people are more obese or poor people are more obese? You would guess. You got more resources. You'll spend more money on calories. You guess that it's going to be rich people.
Well, and historically too. I mean, you would see in these like historical dramas, right? You got the opulent, you know, monarch sitting at a, you know, a banquet table full of food, and he's just stuffing his face with turkey legs and God knows what, you know, drowning himself in wine. Like, that was kind of the more of the archetype, I guess you could say. Certainly switched.
Yeah, for sure. And and now it's actually quite the opposite. The richer you are, the healthier you are, the more discipline you have in your personal life, the more likely you are to exercise that in your diet. And, you know, and that's highly correlated with economic success, because you're more likely to stay in school, not have kids in your teens, and get married and stay married and have a stable relationship. Those are the economic social indicators of economic success. It's a pretty simple algorithm. So when you look at that, you wouldn't guess, you know, unless you don't have like a multidimensional model, that it would be the very poorest among us that are often the most obese. And that's usually associated with disability and other things like that, too. But are also associated highly with poor impulse control and an ability to, you know, restrain what you're doing. Like, so you, you know, will skip work every now and then maybe that you lose your job, and these things kind of like a spiral. And I know this from personal experience, like people in my life who have struggled with making money and holding on a job and what those folks are like. And that's a reality. So if they're going to be on the dole, to what degree should we do that? So like, the economic, the libertarian argument at, you know, like for simplicity is we shouldn't do all of this control on them, but we should have a low dollar amount, right? So it should be a straight cash payment, pay for your rent, pay for your food, pay for whatever you want to pay for, spend it on whatever, but this is all you're getting, right? And you get a job, you get above that, and you can keep that job and until you get to a certain rate of total income, and then we'll start to taper that down. That would be the best model, like economically efficient plan. But that does place a lot more responsibility on those folks, right? So you're kind of saying, therefore, it can't be a lot of money. It has to be a little bit of money. So then they have to economize and figure out how they're going to run their lives, granted that. So there's economic efficiency gain there. But by no means in the current situation that we're currently at, would you therefore imply the idea that they should be able to spend SNAP dollars not on whole food, but rather on snacks and sugary drinks?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's another aspect to it as well, the economic disparity and the disparity of, you know, obesity correlating in that way. And that is also the fact that the government subsidizes a lot of these really less than nutritious ingredients, right? I mean, we've got corn and we've got soy and, we've got, you know, canola and all these cash crops that they're subsidizing at the agricultural level that are making their way into food products because they're cheaper. And so you end up getting these artificially cheap, shitty ingredients, which are terrible for human health, making their way into food that is just the most affordable. So when you don't have a lot of money, what are you going to buy but the cheapest thing that you possibly can in that instance? And you know what I would love to see is RFK circle up with the Department of Agriculture and figure out a way to end the subsidies that are going on for all these cheap ingredients that are making their way into the food that are disproportionately affecting the poorest among us, and figure out a way to like get farmers through that, because I know a lot of farmers have become dependent upon those subsidies. So how can we transition ourselves from the ground up, from the agricultural level through the food supply, you know, get ourselves into a place where the farmers are taken care of, we're getting better food into people's hands, we're not enabling, you know, these super processed addictive foods going into the hands of the people that are the most at risk of being negatively affected by them.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's and this has been a long-term case, right? I mean, we subsidize corn, it winds up in corn syrup, everyone else uses sugar. A lot of that has to do with the tariffs on the on protecting the American sugar law, you know, sugar industry, which is very small because we can't produce that much sugar because of just natural reasons. You know, and so, and this is one of those areas where tariffs are really damaging the American public and have since the last century. So we should really consider about, you know, both the health benefits, but these are the long-term collateral consequences of protectionism as well.
Yeah. Well, circling back to the conversation around these influencers being paid to basically shill big soda, what's been the fallout from this? Has there been any reconciliation over it?
So there has been some news articles. I didn't get to dive into many of them, but I thought the most relevant was this tweet from Nick Doughty. Doughty. Yeah, that was dumb of me. Massive egg on my face. In all seriousness, it won't happen again. What are we doing here? What are we doing?
Bro, there is one thing that this guy needs to understand. Eric Daughtry. Yeah. One thing he needs to understand about reputation is it takes a lifetime to build and a second to destroy. And being called out, shilling for Big Soda in the face of one of the more popular movements within the greater MAGA universe, the Make America Healthy Again movement, bro, you just destroyed any credibility that you have. I'm sorry. It's time to hang it up and go find a job lobbying for Big Soda, I guess. They'd probably take him in, wouldn't they?
Yeah, it's really sad, right? I mean, like, you just watching someone give away their integrity for something so pithy and small, and being lazy about it too, like not even changing the words or changing the message substantially. I mean, it just goes to show you, like, if you follow those people, you should unfollow them now, punish them for it, and say, I will not take that from my media sources. This is a moment for the conservative media network of alternative media space to actually hold their people to account. And that's critical. Otherwise, you just perverse incentives all over. You're no different than legacy media at that point.
Absolutely. And I was just going to say, it reminds me so much of this moment a couple of weeks ago when all those Democrats rolled out their, you know, scripted piece about how, you know, shit that didn't happen or whatever. They were talking about the Trump administration in some very, you know, derogatory way. And it was so clear. This is so completely astroturfed. And now for the right to be engaging in the same thing is just completely hypocritical. And it's an example of, again, this the free speech conversation. It's terrible to censor people when it's conservatives being censored. Now we have to censor people when they're critical of Israel's policies as with regard to Gaza. Like, 100%. Conservatives have to fucking have principles. They have to. People expect it now, and it's so easy to get caught out in these lies and to be exposed. Like, don't.
Yeah.
Have principles.
If you make an ill-informed mistake, if you have a take that you're like, wait, I was way off on that and I was wrong, bring that out. But you got caught taking money for your opinion, right? That's a very different thing. And at that point, I don't know what you do. I mean, but it better be a better apology than my bad.
Seriously, dude. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so we can safely say here, we take very little money from anyone. As a matter of fact, we have basically less than no money. So we're not getting bought or sold by anyone. Our opinions are our own, and you can count on that. And they always will be. Even if we do have sponsors, it's like, look, they're here to support the show. But what comes first is the integrity of what we have to say. We're going to say it truthfully. That's been something we've said from the very beginning, and that'll never change.
Absolutely. We've been having a great discussion on RFK and banning, related issue, banning pharmaceuticals from television in the Discord. So if you're not part of the Discord, jump in there and you get to see me go back and forth with some of our best supporters and listeners. We have great disagreements, and that's a good thing. That's actually a good thing. So please come check out the Discord, join in, become a member, and you can get access to the SCIF and our special Discord the chat discussions as well. That's limited only to Secure Containment Information Facility members. So please go check those things out.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, I want to know where you fall on that issue, because I'm terribly curious.
Haven't been reading the Discord, have you? So, I mean, in short, I think if there was any scrutiny to it on its constitutional merits, I think it's very problematic.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Just simply because, I mean, the case around tobacco and its ban is around the fact that it has no medicinal purposes, right? But what we're talking about is medicine. So like, it does. And now, don't get me wrong, you might be like, all the pharmaceutical medicine's wrong. And that's on the text definitions, what we're talking about is medicine, right? I mean, like, and that's where legal code is decided. And then the principal question is mostly one around of, is there a just role for government to tell people that they can't talk about their product on a willing platform's willingness to host them? To me, you know, although I'm totally sympathetic to the skepticism of the pharmaceutical industry, I don't think the ends ever justify the means. The action, the virtue of the actions and the deed of the action.
That is perfectly fair. That is having principle, and I appreciate that about you. And I can see how a lot of people would be very swayed, and myself included, thinking about how the legacy media has literally a three-legged step stool left to sit on. And pretty much all three of those legs are pharma dollars at this point. Well, I'd say maybe one of them are military industrial complex dollars. We've got Raytheon and Boeing in there as well. But if those go down, right? If pharma dollars go away, there is very, very little financially keeping the legacy media on its feet. So a part of me would be really pleased if that happened, because what they're buying, what pharma is buying is not, oh, they're not convincing people to go to their doctor and say, hey, I saw this ad for this drug and I think I should take it. What do you think? Give me a prescription for it. What they're buying is silence on the negative effects of their products, which are numerous. And especially if they have legal protection against liability on things, I certainly don't have any lost sleep over them being banned personally from advertising their potentially very deleterious products to me and my community on television. So,
yeah.
But I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that too. If the only thing to me is, if you really wanted to solve the problem, what you would attack is things like patent law, copyright, and you would attack the monopolies of the American Medical Association and all the perverseness of third party pay.
Yeah,
like those are the real problems. And if until you address the real problems, you're really just putting a band on a longer solution.
Absolutely. Well, before we go, we got a very special cameo guest, John Griffin. Oh. Andrew Tate joining us from his living room. What's up, Chris? Nice. Great to see you.
Hey, likewise. Good to be seen. How are we doing tonight?
You know, we're doing great. We're really just tying up the episode, but we're going to go to you for the final word of the show. What do you think should be done? Should there be a public hanging for the conservative influencers who sold their souls to Big Soda this last week?
Shut it all down. Right now, we've got to get out of this little situation where we're back alley dealings of peddling influence across these channels. I think it's absurd, and it's not the first time it's happened, and it's not going to be the last. But now it's very transparent what's going on.
It's very true. It seemed like people picked up on this really quick. Like it was like, and I mentioned this a second ago, it was like when the Democrats all came out, those 20 Democrats, and they posted like the exact same condemnation of the Trump policies. You know, at this point we've got conservatives saying, hey, look at them. They're so stupid for doing that. And then they're doing that. So I think it's great. People picked up on it so quickly, but do you think that this kind of thing is going to happen in the future? Or do you think that this has sort of set the stage for other conservative influencers to be more cautious about who they take money from to say particular things?
It's happening on both sides, right? It's not just a conservative influencer thing. I mean, you've seen it. I think we've seen it for years, particularly with public health activities. So, I mean, it's not going to stop unless people stop sharing it, you know, unless people stop engaging with it.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. And I mean, it seems though like there is more pushback than I've seen for this kind of behavior. I mean, I haven't really seen this kind of behavior from the right on Twitter before. At least I haven't identified it.
No, you're right. Have you heard of your local epidemiologist?
It sounds familiar, yeah.
David, are you familiar with her or them? Or what? No.
Nope.
So she rose to prominence a few years back. She's a PhD epidemiologist, biostatistician, who became a consultant to the Biden administration. Who was it? Rachel Walensky was the head of the CDC, had brought her on to essentially be a mouthpiece for the CDC and advisor too. She's also fiscally sponsored by some organizations that have dealt in pandemic epidemic preparedness and, you know, COVID-19 response. Anyway, she's funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You know, another entity called the Social Good Fund, which has kind of dubious origins. But anyway, she has essentially become the mouthpiece to reiterate the talking points that the previous administration was very much apt to push throughout all of the pandemic. And her Substack has 300 some odd thousand followers. And there is absolutely conversations that a lot of these followers are, we don't know the actual identity of them. Perhaps there's outside funding building up this follower count. Any pushback from people who aren't subscribers to the Substack? You know, she doesn't allow any comments from people who aren't subscribers on the Substack, so you, there's no rebuttal. Anyway, you're starting to there's a lot of, when you start to unravel this lady's career and platform, you're kind of seeing the same thing where you've got this back alley support trying to push certain agendas. So, I mean, until people just stop engaging with it, it's just going to be a thing.
Yeah, no, that's fair. It definitely makes me nervous. You know what else makes me nervous is the fact that you turned your video off on us.
Really?
Don't know why you did that. So, you might have covered it with your hand. Perfect.
That's all right.
That's all right.
I hadn't heard of that lady, and that sounds really interesting. At the end of the day, this is a question of what are the standards that the consumers are going to place upon the people who are producing these, the value here, the actual information deliverers, right? And a discerning public that cares about lies is the one that's going to make the difference here. And I think long-term, that's what the entire migration away from legacy media to more unconventional media has been won around. Well, they got caught lying. They got caught telling us there was weapon of mass destruction in Iraq. They got caught telling us that the vaccine was going to prevent, you know, people being able to transmit or get the COVID-19. So all of that stuff is why these industries are blowing up the way they are and people are rising to prominence. If they trade on that integrity of not being the liars, that's going to be the end of them. If it's systematic, right? And if there's like other people talk about it, right? I imagine a lot of people are like, I don't want to go after these guys because they're bigger than I am and yada, yada, yada. No. We need to call it out not for our benefit, for the health of the ecosystem, so that we actually have an effective, trustworthy alternative, press outside of the legacy media establishment.
Exactly. You don't want to see these voices who are so far respected within the space trade their integrity for a few $100. Yeah. I don't know what they each got paid for this spot. You don't want to see that. Like you said, David, not for their own career. I mean, I could care less about any of their own careers if they have such low standards of their own brand to, you know, trade their authenticity, which is the currency of the internet in this day and age, for, you know, this small cash opportunity. They should be gone. But for the betterment of the whole message, for the betterment of people who are actually trying to do honest journalism and commentary on the internet and have a voice that people listen to, we absolutely need to have a high standard for ourselves and each other and hold each other accountable for that.
100%. Yeah.
Well, Griff, thank you for joining us late. We appreciate you wading through the technical difficulties to join us from your couch. Love those sunglasses, by the way.
Thank you.
They look great on you.
Very effective.
Very effective. Friends, we are going to have Griff back very soon. He is our local microbiologist and serial entrepreneur with a great mind for the health space and the food space. And we're going to be talking all things Maha when those topics arise. So definitely look out for more of Griff on future episodes, buddy.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Have a beautiful evening.
Likewise. Friends, thanks for watching. This has been Human Reaction for David Rand and John Griffith. I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.